Hello, welcome to The Addict's Advocate, a podcast geared towards the suffering addict and those in recovery. This podcast does not provide any medical advice. No material on this podcast is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare professional with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome again to another episode of The Addict's Advocate. I am your host, Dusty Dean, and it is my pleasure to introduce to you a friend of mine named Emily. How are you doing, Em?
I am good. How are you, Dusty? It's great
to be on. I'm good.
Yeah.
It's great to see you. It's been a while.
Yes, it has.
And lots to catch up on.
Absolutely.
But just, you know, I typically start off the show, asking, my guest to kind of, give a little background on yourself and what got you to the point of needing to seek help.
Sure. Well, mine's the typical story of being overworked, being overtired. I think like most of us, we were pretty much born alcoholics. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom would say she's not an alcoholic, but but we never know with that. So kind of grew up around that. My dad went into recovery as well, so he's now 3 years sober. So that's been helpful to have him around for that. But grew up around alcohol. I didn't really start drinking until I was about 25. And then kind of failed at it because when I was 27, I had been drinking so much due to work and stress and, just being able to like go home, drink like a handle of vodka. I ended up getting pancreatitis. So actually flatlined from that. And you would think that that would make me stop drinking. So I was 27 when I got that. But no, it didn't. My hepatologist said I was in the clear 6 months later and I was like, all right, let's keep drinking. So started going to wine because wine apparently was fine. Wine is fine. And I definitely abused that. So I moved to, San Jose and had a new job and just was kind of alone. And my job was really stressful. I was just kind of manipulated on it. I wasn't very happy. I wasn't really getting visibility. And I didn't really know anyone around, brand new place. And I was just when I actually went into recovery, I had just gotten married. So, but that was after it went downhill. So, I started drinking a lot. I was drinking a bottle or two a day of wine. I was drinking at work, which, I mean, you look back on that and you're like, oh my God, that's so stupid. But I had to. And I was drinking like while driving. I was filling up water bottles. I mean, it was just really bad. But every time I tried, I would get serious shakes. I would just get super nauseous. And I'd be like, all right, I can't do this alone. Like, I'm going to have to go get detox, which I was in the hospital multiple times and would get a detox for a couple days. And then I'd go back and just start drinking again. It was just really bad. So in 2023, what a golden year. Oh, my goodness. It went downhill. Starting in January, I was in the hospital every single month. And it was from hypokalemia. It was from lack of potassium, which is from drinking, right? It was from dehydration. It was from tachycardia. So basically my heart was just palpitating all of the time. And it just got really bad. So, I started drinking liquor sometimes, which I didn't really do before. But when I drank, I would drink all of the liquor. So I would binge. That would be my binge drinking. So I'd still be drinking consistently every day wine. But when I went on a binge, I would drink Fireball. I would drink a handle of Grey Goose. I would drink tequila, Don Julio, El Patron. That was my favorite. So I would drink those all in like the matter of 3 days if it got really bad. So it was really, I was hiding it from my husband. At the time, he was my fiance. I was hiding it from him. He knew the places I was hiding liquor. He would let me drink wine. I mean, anyone would let me drink wine, but he didn't have an issue with that so much. But, Yeah, so I continued to be in the hospital every month, at least once a month. And it would always stem from something that had to do with alcohol. And I would just deny it and deny it. And, you know, my old best friend would say, if you're thinking you're an alcoholic, then you're not an alcoholic. And now she is my old best friend, because clearly that's not the right mind of thinking. So, so it got really bad. And then a couple days after my wedding, which was in July, I got 5150'd, and that spurred for me getting seriously cyber attacked. And, you know, that was just a huge stress. It lasted about 5 months, but it tore me apart. So, you know, I was asked, do you want to be here? And at that point, I didn't really have a reason to. I said, I don't know. I don't want to be here. And, you know, they took that as I was a threat to myself. And I was. I had taken some pills and then I spit them out, but I had the intention of just ending it right there. And I just wasn't thinking. So that's when I was 5150. They put me in the loony bin, which you never want to go to. And apparently I got the 5-star treatment. So I was put in the literal worst one that you can possibly think of, because the paramedic I'd had before, and he just had it out for me. Probably because I had thrown up in his ambulance once on his feet. But yeah, I was the usual. I was a regular. They called me a VIP at the hospital, very important patient. So, that was when and then just a couple days after that, I guess it was a week after that, I flew up to Seattle, and was just there for a day trip. And, then I got apprehended at the airport. So kind of knew everything was going wrong around that time. And, I wanted to get help and I didn't know how. I didn't know what to do. I'm sure you had the same sort of feeling, but I tried to go cold turkey, did not work. I was super sick. I was having DTs. I was probably hallucinating. And so that lasted for about a week. And then I called up my dad, who again, he had gone through recovery. He kind of knew the ins and outs, and we went and toured a place. Am I allowed to say the name? Okay. Yep. SVR, where I met you, Dusty. And, you know, I loved it. I thought it was just like a home. I'm still very nervous, but, went in the next day, and it was downhill or uphill. Not downhill, uphill from there. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. It was really just a mixture of stress from work, at that point I had already lost my job, which I'm sure stemmed from all my drinking, but they didn't know that. So, that's pretty much how I got into it. And thank goodness for that.
You know, you brought up a couple good points. And, you know, it's our coping mechanisms, right? We're overworked, mm-hmm. We're overtired. And There's no education on how to do that correctly, right? It's usually only post fact, and that's a scary thing, because, you know, we can't do this thing alone, right? And if we've never dealt with mental health, at least consciously dealt with our mental health or just our work life balance, et cetera, it's only talked to us, you know, after we're at a crisis level, right? There's no upbringing. I mean, and even, you know, high schools and colleges would really do benefit by talking about these things. You know, helping people understand that, you know, this, you know, the struggles aren't something new, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
When I basically at the end of July last year, I'd basically realized that I was in a massively depressed situation, you know, and I realized that I was actually in a mixed state, because through my mental health, you know, I've come to understand that, and I've questioned it for some time. I've had psychiatrists question it, but it's basically agreed upon that I've got some form of bipolar. And so, gotcha. And so with, you know, the anxiety and the depression from, you know, obviously from just that inherently being there with bipolar, but also exacerbating it through alcohol use, it's, you know, it's a perfect storm. And I did that same thing. I was like, I give up. I don't know what to do. I admitted myself into ER. got myself a doctor, got myself, you know, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and it still wasn't enough because I was left to my devices, you know, for too long of a period. So then I probably went on like 12 benders in August. And and it was just, I was just cycling every other day, right?
Yep.
I'd feel like shit for doing it. And then I'd start right back up and just go hard. And then I'd feel bad. And then I'd start again and did some stupid things. And, you know, thankfully nothing permanent, you know, damaging happened. And then it was at that point, you know, it was August 21st, 20th, 21st. I was like, I concede. Somebody take me. Put me somewhere, throw away the key, and you know, because I conceded, and I think that that's an important part of recovery, right? Is surrendering to it,
exactly.
You know, removing yourself from the labels, right? You know, it's like you're an addict, you're this, you know, and it's just like it's just words, and you know, and I'm fine with saying that, right? Because I know that normies don't understand us; they just don't understand.
No, they do not.
And I think, you know, that one of the most powerful things for a normie to understand is that, you know, I guess there's three rules, right? When it comes to learning about alcoholism or addiction in general through Al-Anon is that, you know, number one, you didn't cause it. Number two, you can't control it. And number three, you can't cure it.
Right.
So get those things out of your head because, I mean, I've got family members that wanted to fix it. You know, they're just like, you know, we can just fix you. And it's like, no, you can't fix me. I am what I am. How has your family responded to your efforts of your sobriety now?
That's a really good question. So my family did the same thing. Some of them, you know, I don't talk to my sister anymore or my nieces and nephews, unfortunately, through my alcoholism. That was something that happened, you know, when I was visiting at home, they just didn't trust me with the kids, which was a hard take. That was hard. But yeah, so I had a team in my recovery. I had my husband, my new husband. I had my dad who had dealt with addiction. I had my mom who was my cheerleader. She just really wanted me to get better, and all of them did. And then, you know, my stepdad and my in-laws, and you know, I was given a ton of love. I was given a ton of support, which didn't make it any easier. You know, it's really something that is inside of you. But my mom tried to understand. She cannot. And bless her heart, she tried to fix me. She would say, I'm so glad you're back to the old Emma. You're back to the old you. And I'm like, I'm not back to the old me. I'm a new and improved me. Like, don't tell me that. And even recently she had visited. And, you know, it's those little tiny remarks where it's just like, don't say things like that, where she had said, you're not going to drink though, right, Emily? Right. And I was like, Mom, yeah, okay. I'm not going to drink. I'm still sober. Like, we're good. Like, we're not going to have alcohol. Yes. I don't need the condescending remarks, but, you know, she just really does. She tries, and she goes to those Thursday night or Wednesday night meetings with, it was people who visited for the parent weekend or the family weekend. So she does that weekly, and she really, really enjoys it. What she says is that she feels so bad because I'm doing so well that she feels like she's like bragging if she says anything, which, you know, that's great for her, but she really has learned a lot from that. I learned a lot how to deal with addicts, and you know, I haven't gone to an Al-Anon meeting or anything like that, but I'm curious to see what they teach them because it really, really does help. I think it really does. And then I keep up with my dad every so often. He'll ask me, what day are you on? What day is it? And, it's nice to be able to talk to him. And I remember at one point he asked if I wanted him to be my sponsor. And I was like, that's not how it works. So, that's been great. And, you know, my husband, who is a normie, he no longer drinks, just out of respect for me, and he doesn't smoke weed. We don't smoke weed. I know some people do, that are alcoholics, but, we just never really did that when I got back. We kind of just wanted to keep it easy, and he never had an issue with alcohol. So it was really easy for him to kind of kick it, and he can still drink it socially. Right when I got out, about a week later, It was my birthday and I was turning 31 and it was a ton of alcohol around me because it was a joint birthday with my father-in-law. And so they had friends over. We went over to his house and there was just alcohol everywhere. I mean, every single kind of alcohol you could possibly think of. I think there were probably 40 bottles. And so everyone was just drinking and they kept on asking, "Are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay?" And I'm sure you get the same sort of thing, right? So that's still something that happens. "Emily, you're going to be okay. Emily, are you going to be okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine. I won't be okay if you keep on saying that." So, it's still an adjustment for a lot of people. And I know you said, you know, you're really open about it. And I'm super open about it with my family. You know, my grandparents, like, bless their heart, they live in West Virginia and all they wanted was for me to get better. All of my dad's side of the family, all they wanted was for me to get better. And, you know, I don't have grandparents on my mom's side anymore, but seriously, everyone was just so supportive and, they just didn't want me to die. And it broke my heart to hear, you know, my stepdad, he couldn't even read the letter to me because my mom wrote a letter to me and my husband did and my stepdad. And we were reading them to each other. I had written a couple to them too. And we were reading each other on camera and he just couldn't even bring words. I've never seen this man cry. He couldn't even speak. And his main thing was, "I was just so scared you were going to die." And again, you know, I had already killed myself with it. I just didn't take it seriously. I'd been in the hospital so much. I'm still paying those hospital bills. So that's really, really it's hard to hear when your parents or your family are just like, "I was just so scared you were going to die. Anything would have been better than that." So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah, I mean, and they're afraid, right? Because they don't know what they can do, right? In order to help you. My mother is interesting because, you know, she grew up in an alcoholic family. She remembers pulling my grandfather off of my grandmother. And so when I was first in SVR, I had said, you know, "Hey, there's these classes that you can attend, right? That's, you know, that's, you know, for families, you know, dealing with it." And her response was, "What am I going to learn from that I haven't learned in the 40, 50 years of just growing up around it?" Mm. And it was like, you know, I mean, so there was like a resistance in participation, which is like, okay, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was that, you know, she saw a cycle of me change through the life of, you know, before it, during it, and after it. And, you know, I used to call her two or three times a day, and a lot of it was just anxiety driven, and her just brain was just working way too fast.
Yep.
And you know, and that's the thing I think with being having intelligence, you know, you kind of make things worse for yourself. You know,
yep.
Nice to be, if you were dumb and alcoholic, that's one thing, but if you're smart and alcoholic, that's something else.
That's a whole other thing. Yeah.
Right. But she had noticed that, you know, she's just like, "You just sound so much better on the phone," right? Even at SVR, like towards the end, she's like, "You just sound so much better."
Yeah.
Anything else. But then what happened was that I didn't need to talk to her as much.
Yep.
You know, I was living life and she all of a sudden, so that became offensive to her.
Yeah.
She's like, "We used to talk all the time, you know, and now we hardly ever talk to each other." And it just and I'm just like, "I'm sorry, Mom. I'm just kind of, I'm having okay days and those are good things."
Yeah.
And she actually has a friend of hers, fortunately, thank God, because there's this new side of me. I mean, again, you know, I've had something in me since I was 18. Right. And you know, I'm 48 now. So, I mean, so it's 30 years, and the last 23 years were really the hard run, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And she was explaining to her friend just about how I'm not the same Dustin. And she's like, "She never will be. He never will be." He's like, "You have to get used to that. He's probably a person you've never met or you don't ever remember meeting anymore." And she's like, that's the way that it's going to be. So she actually invited my mom to come to like some of her meetings and like listen in and stuff like that, like things that are virtual and, you know, helping, you know, family members of Al-Anon and everything. And so I'm like, thank God. I'm like, go get that education, Mom. You need it, right? you need. Yes. And you know, what's interesting is that once, you know, the problem with my first go around was that I didn't get enough intensive mental health care when I was trying to deal with my detox. That's why it was failing for me all mm-hmm. throughout August. So that's mm-hmm. the beauty of SVR is the dual diagnosis, yeah. the ability to manipulate your meds, because I tell you, it's like,
oh yeah,
as long as I'm on my meds, I'm like, I am golden. I have no yeah. desire, no urge. I'm yep. living life. I'm present. And it's like, yeah. hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Yep. I'm with you. I mean, that was a godsend, and it was the right amount of like everything. They really did tailor it to you. So it was right. perfect way of like really, really getting to the person that you, you know, naturally would be without all of this. So.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
What would you say are valuable pieces of information that still resonate with you from your education and rehabilitation?
So we got a lot of education, right? We were taught so much that, I mean, no one knew before. I don't know how they would, which kind of goes back to your point of like, of what people should really learn this in school or something. But a lot of it just breaks down to, you know, it is genetic. It is, something that you could be born with. It is not your fault. And the main thing is it's an allergy. So you really do have an allergy to alcohol. Like for me, it's alcohol. I know I'm not addicted. I was never addicted to narcotics or anything like that. But it's really, you know, it's just something that's in you that you can't really help. And the only way to deal with it is just by not having anything around you. You can't control it. It's a beast. I mean, it's a beast you're always going to be burdened with. It's a fight you're always going to have to deal with. But, a lot of the education was through, Alcoholics Anonymous, which I really, really dove into. I know a lot of people who didn't, and I know a lot of people who don't, and they're fine. A lot of addicts that don't do Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. And, they're fine, and that's they deal with it. They can go on by just that. But also, what I got out of that was a huge community of people who were teaching you, who had, you know, their stories were just so many of them were homeless, or you know, had a family die, or they were, you know, about to die, or had so many things happen to them. They lost their jobs, they lost their home, they lost everything. And they were just so brave to tell those stories. So I really learned that it's about community a lot. And you really need to have that. And you really do need to be knowledgeable about what chemicals and like the chemical balance that's in your brain. You need to be able to understand yourself as well. It's a lot of psychopathy. It's a lot of psychotherapy. And it's very important to know who you are and to dive into those feelings. It's really critical. So, in doing that, you have the community of people around you who have dealt with these things that finally understand you, because like you said, no one who is a normie is ever going to understand. And those are typically the people we're surrounded with, right? Unless you're in one of these programs or you've gone to recovery. And so it's so nice to know that and to learn that there are ways to cope. There are mechanisms to cope. You can meditate. You can be in the community. You can where you can share. And people really care for you, and they want knowing what you've gone through. They want to be by your side, and they want to help you continue to get better. So there's a lot of education when it comes to that. I mean, I know we got lessons a lot about like our brain chemical makeup, and also just dealing with our emotions. And sometimes it's easier to just ignore them and to push things away. And that's how a lot of people turn to alcohol or to narcotics. But it's really important to know yourself and to have a goal and to really be out for number one. Right. So, yeah, so there are a lot of different things I learned. I learned a lot about myself. I learned how strong I was, and I'm sure you did too. Because look at us now, right? Like, who goes into these recovery? I had no idea what to expect. I mean, I had done a tour, which no one does, right? That's just me. So I had done a tour just so I could do my homework, and I was so terrified, and everyone was like, oh, you're not going to go. But I tried to understand what I'd be going through, and then I hear, oh, they were taking your phone for 21 days, and I'm like, oh my god, and I freak out, right? So once you get past that, by the way, I, like, hate looking at my phone now. I hate it. I'm constantly working on it, and I get, like, overstimulated, really, by it. It was so nice not to have it, but you just learn so much about yourself by just being away from the world a little bit and by being around people who really care. Like, we all became family, right?
Yeah, so. The losing the phone was actually an unrealized welcome event. I mean, it was like,
Wasn't it? This is so freeing.
It's so freeing.
I know.
And, you know, life became instantly so much simpler. Right.
It really
just
did.
Removing that one element. They should definitely have treatment centers for that phone withdrawal.
Yeah, I know. Oh, it's a real thing. That's a real addiction too.
Do you have any routines or daily habits that you've now implemented in your life that are new?
Yeah. So, I go to bed early, and thank goodness for the meds on that one, right? Like, we love the good, quetiapine, right? But I go to bed early. I try to get to bed by like 9, and I still wake up at around 6:30 or 7 every day, even if it's on the weekend, which I would sleep until 2 p.m. Like on weekends, right. Things like that. I was just like, I would sleep in on weekdays and be like, oh, I'm just like at a dentist appointment or something to, you know, making up lies to just go into work late or something. So I make sure to wake up. And I set my alarms and I take my medications. I've now gotten off of all of my, antidepressants and almost all my anti-anxiety, because I have extreme general anxiety disorder and always have, which, you know, contributes a lot to the drinking portion. But, I've gotten in the routine of always making my bed. That's something that we did at SVR, and that is something I continue to do. And I try not to use my phone. So on Saturdays, I make a point of literally, if I don't have to pick up the phone or, you know, respond to a text or something, then I won't. I will just put my phone in like a drawer, which is what we did at SVR, right? Just because it's so overstimulating throughout the week, you get your emails, you get your texts, you got your phone calls. And it's just, sometimes you just need to breathe. And, I definitely pray. I pray a lot. And I make sure that I remember how grateful I am for all of the wonderful things in my life, and that I am alive, and that I have people around me that love me, and I have friends that love me, that are just like me, you know, they've gone through the same things, and I have a support system, and I have people that I care about now that I want to see succeed in fighting this battle. And, you know, it's, that's something that I really think is important. And if the only thing I say is I will be done, then that's what I get. I get a prayer out of that too. It's just be grateful, be humble, just be so thankful for the experiences that you have. And by the time I left SVR, I was like, I am going to miss this so much. Right. You know, we woke up, we had each other, we had a routine of different things that we would do every day. We had, you know, our meals cooked for us. Thank chef. Oh my gosh. What a blessing she was. Yeah. And you know, we had people to hold us accountable, and we went to our therapy, and we did activities like candle making, and, you know, right now I do Sudoku. Like, there's always a craft or something I want to do just to like take my mind off of things and relax. And then, you know, we went and saw the horses, which you were so great with, right? Remember Mac? Yeah. So, I mean, it was really, really important to have some sort of routine. And so I've definitely kept that, just the going to sleep at a reasonable time, waking up at a reasonable time, making sure that you are like paying your bills and like on time and like being, you know, doing your duties. And like, it's just, that's really, really important. So, and, you know, now I work, and I love working. That's a huge part of who I am. If I love my job, that's if I love my job. And I was very fortunate enough to get a job right out of recovery, which was my biggest concern. So I really, really enjoy going to work and making, like, finding solutions and just diving into that. And, you know, it's not something that I think, like, I don't think about drinking a lot because of that. It's not a part of my daily routine anymore. So it's been pretty good. I mean, but there are definitely those routines that you have to have. Like, I'm sure you have some, right?
Oh yeah. You know, that's the biggest thing is just that I'm engaged in life. Right. Mm-hmm. Addiction's so isolating. Right.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're no longer in that. And you've got this, again, community of people that are just surrounding you. And I mean, again, I have so many friends now, right. We talk all the time, even if it's just simple right. texts, hey, checking in and everything. And on top of that, it's just like, I've got this free time, right? Because I'm no longer, you know, going and sipping a sip or smoking a blunt or, you know, whatever I'm doing, right? Just to get out of my own head. It's like, everything's just kind of, it's slowed down to the right frequency that now I can actually mm-hmm. function in this world. So yeah, you know, I think for me, it's, you know, because when I left SVR, I thought for sure it was going to be like a stopping of SVR and starting this new life, right?
Yeah.
But what I found was that there was a limbo. It was like, oh, shit, you know, I'm back in my old environment, but I'm no longer doing the things I used to do. So I was thankful. Mm-hmm. It was only like a week and a half before I got into IOP because I needed it. I needed it, right?
I started mine right after. Yep.
Yeah. 30 days, you know, of help from a 2-decade-plus issue. Yeah, it's never enough. And and I think, you know, it's daunting when people are unaware of it and they find out in their treatment, like, this is just the start. They're like, no, wait a second. I bargained for 30 days. That's it. You know, I'm not bargaining for 60, 90. But it's so important, right?
It is. Because,
the habits are so strong. So, yeah, I think that it's all, you know, and that's the, one of the things I just wish people would take away. And that was one of the main catalysts for me doing this was because, you know what, there are so many people that understand you that you have no idea who they are. And the only way you're going to get connected into them is if you step out into this world of, you know, AA meetings, NA meetings, and, or, you know, go simply get help, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, so one of the things that I like to do obviously towards the end of this, you know, I guess one thing, first of all, is that what things are surprising to you? Some realizations being in sobriety that you've just kind of, I've had, for example, I had an individual tell me, they like, I went back to school and I've freaking, I'm killing it in school, college.
Yeah.
And now you're like, and they're like, it's just something that, you know, I love to do. And I have other people that are like, I was concerned that my creative juices weren't going to be flowing again. And now they're flowing in abundance. I'm doing artwork. I'm doing all these things. Right. And it's just, it's satisfying, right. It's, you know, it's filling. So what sort of things, I mean, because I know that you are brilliant and you know, the thing is that most, you know, there's not the stereotypical, you know, addict shaking in the corner, you know, talking to themselves, you know, degenerate type of, you know, caveat that a lot of people that are struggling with addiction believe they're going to put themselves in an environment with people like that. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. We've met so many people that are just absolutely brilliant in their own right. And I think that's part of the crux of the brilliant sometimes is that sometimes this thing goes way too fast. Right. And you're looking to try
you
to find a better
to
frequency.
Turn it off. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
So I guess one of the most surprising, well, it's not really too surprising, but because I didn't remember how I was at work without drinking, I thought that I wouldn't be social, or I thought that, you know, I wouldn't be able to make friends. And I grew a family, right? So like I going to meetings and really diving into the events, I became a secretary. That was super fun. But I also was able to really enjoy work again, which I had so much PTSD from just being let go from jobs. And, you know, it was just, and I work in the tech world. So that's just what happens. Like they'll just try to cut you out if you're making too much money or if like your brain is too fast and they don't quite understand. Right. So I had been just so used to that. And now I am in a place where I feel appreciated. And that's something I can actually witness now. I can feel it like fully. And I feel like I'm using my brain to the highest power. You know, it's really, really rewarding. I'm still very creative. I have a music room. So I still play the piano, the drums and the flute and, you know, anything I can get my hands on, really, the guitar. And so, you know, I take time to do that. I take time to, I have a record collection. Music is a really big part of me. And it's something that kind of went away for a bit when I was drinking so much. I wasn't playing. I wasn't writing. I wasn't doing anything like that. And it's fully come back, and it's really, really rewarding. It's really relaxing as well. So that's been a welcome surprise, is to be able to try and learn new instruments. And like my brain allows me to. It's not like I'm forgetting everything. And then also something else that's really surprised me is that I'm actually pretty affluent. And when it comes to words, and I always thought that I I didn't know any words or anything like that. I'm mathematical, right? So I'll just throw out some of these words where I'm like, oh, that's where it's been hiding. Like my brain is still there and I hear it. So just little things like that, surprising. And yeah, it's just, it is really rewarding just to be able to enjoy life again. Just like you said, I thought that I wouldn't have friends. I thought that I wouldn't be able to go to a club and go dancing, which, oh my goodness, that's like everything to me. And I'm still me. I'm still me. That's the biggest surprise, is that I still feel like I have all of those things that they were probably being hindered by alcohol. And I thought the alcohol is boosting them, or I did. I was worried that I would not be, you know, as funny. I would not be as like relaxed. I would not be, you know, as loving or caring, but it comes to, and I'm like better than before, right? It's new and improved Emily. And so that's been really surprising, is that. And again, that goes back to the strength. I think the strength of finding yourself again.
Right. Yeah, I went to Nashville in December, and
no, that's so funny. I was just thinking about going there last night. I'm not joking. That's funny.
And we had, and of course, you know, we went to like Luke Bryan's place. We went to Justin Timberlake's place. And I mean, we were dancing, having a good time, and I was completely bone cold sober, and I was enjoying myself, and I'm like, wow, this is kind of cool.
Yeah, right. It's surprising too. Yeah. I know.
Definitely, I had a recent guest who basically says, you know what, I fell back in love with life. And I'm like, that's so
nice
powerful.
To hear.
Yeah,
that is so nice
powerful.
To hear. Yeah.
Okay, now typically I combine these couple of questions, but if you had somebody who knew that you were managing your sobriety, felt like they could confide in you, and they're saying, hey, you know, I think I might have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to that person, and what sort of things that were like, I guess, gems of wisdom for yourself that you could maybe pass on to somebody to help them kick that over, right? Because we know that, you know, obviously admission is one thing, right?
Yeah.
And secondly, there has to be a surrender, right? You have to surrender to be able to get help, right? So what would you say to someone who came to you that was like looking for answers on how to deal with, you know, this recognition?
You know, I'd say it's scary. I would say it's not something that I ever thought that I would do either. But if you think that you have a problem, don't ignore that. Listen to yourself. There's something to that. And I'd also say, you know, if you don't have anyone, if you feel like you need someone to actually walk up to that door with you, I had to do the same thing. I had to get my dad to come up from SoCal, and he literally had to help me find everything. It had to be smooth sailing. I would offer that to them. That was one of the biggest things is that, you know, my mom thanks my dad all the time because, and they're not together anymore, but because he saved my life, because everyone thought I wouldn't do it by myself. And I probably wouldn't have. You kind of need to have your hand held a little bit when something is that scary. It's really hard to do it alone, but it's so rewarding, and there is a better life afterwards. There's just so much hope, and there is just truly, that's, I would just be real with them. It's hard at first, but it gets so much easier, and it's surprising how much easier it is. Like, it's, you know, 5 days in, you're like, oh, I'm cool, like, this is fine. And you know, you're not alone, and you meet so many great people, and there are so many great stories to hear. But really, like, it's just so much, it's so much brighter on the other side. And that they, I would just make sure they knew that I would hold their hand. Like, if they needed it, if they needed a hand to hold, I would walk them up to that door. I would be by their side. It's hard to go into that with someone who doesn't know what it's like. So, right. I mean, if my mom had dropped me off, if my husband had just dropped me off at the door, it would have been really isolating. It would have been really scary. Yeah. But just having that, you know, having my dad who had had that experience, and just knowing that, you know, my finances were going to be okay. Like, that's still fine, right? This is something that you need to do. It's going to make your life better. It's going to make you happier. And it's gonna make you even more thankful and grateful for every second of the day. And it's fun. It's also really fun. So
that's I think one of the surprising things too is that, you know, once you get past the detox, right? It's like, you know, wow, this is a whole bunch of new learning experiences, a whole bunch of fun experiences.
And you're never alone. Like, you're never alone. You can have your alone time, and that's fine, but, like, you're trusted and you're not alone. There are people out there that just want to hang out with you all day, right? Like, we hung out all day, like, every day, just, like, what, 15 of us, and we were just having the times of our lives. It was great.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. So, like, detox is like that? What? Yeah, once you get past everything, you know, Em, this has been awesome. I appreciate it. I appreciate you. It's great to see you. And I think
it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm so glad that you invited me on here, Desi. I missed you.
Yeah, I missed you too. Well, thank you. Okay, and we'll keep in touch. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.